Welcome to Common Good, the Values and Capitalism podcast, brought to you by the American Enterprise Institute. This is Tyler Castle coming from downtown Washington, D.C. in the 11th floor studio at AEI. I'm joined by Josh Good. We just had our summer conference last week. Could you give me any highlights from that, Josh? It was a great group.
Sure, glad to. We had like 91 students and 34 professors coming in from a number of schools around the country. And on opening night, we had Robert Doerr, our new mortgage fellow in poverty studies here, talk about the reductions in welfare caseload in New York and some of the core principles behind that. It was a terrific address. He talked about personal responsibility and incentivizing work and rewarding work and helping the economy to actually grow, and had the group spellbound. We're actually going to be posting video from that talk and from a number of other talks throughout the course of those 3 days on our website.
And, you know, I think that talk was especially good because some of the more conservative, libertarian-leaning students in the audience were kind of thinking, you know what, welfare is actually not a bad thing. You know, it can be good if it's well-structured and well-planned. So I think that was a good start to the conference, showing students that, you know, government is not evil, but, you know, we need to do it wisely.
Yeah, that's right, good. In a measured way. And then we went to Acton University.
Yeah, it was
literally
fun.
Days later. The two
Grand
of us
Rapids.
Went out and gave away a whole bunch of Arthur's book, Wealth and Justice, and had a great time there.
Any highlights from that?
Sure, I'll give one. Andy Crouch, who's actually going to be a speaker at another event we're going to do here in September with some evangelical leaders, gave a keynote address that was just terrific on his new book, Playing God.
Yeah.
And he had us walk through Lord Acton's dictum that power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely, and said there's an insight there, but it's not entirely true that power in itself can be used constructively and well, and gave a marvelous talk. We actually have a little blog post on the website about Andy's book, Playing God.
Yeah, it's a really good book and a good sort of reminder that, you know, power is a good thing ultimately. It's God's gift to us to have dominion over earth, but it can obviously be corrupted, as the Acton phrase goes. So our guest this episode is Jay Richards. We had an event about a month and a half ago for The Least of These, a book by Institute for Faith, Work, and Economics. So he spoke during that event, and he's going to touch on that a little bit in our discussion. He's a prolific author, a senior fellow at the Discovery Institute now, and we'll hear his thoughts on David Brett and the Eric Cantor primary election, his explanation of why libertarians need God, as well as the path to prosperity. And also, he told me that he's a self-proclaimed Lord of the Rings nerd, so we're going to talk about hobbits a little bit.
Nice.
I'll let him explain why that is relevant at all. But it's a great conversation. Thanks for joining for a few minutes, Josh.
Happy to be here.
Yep. And we'll be back with Jay Richards, our guest.
Is this just an illusion that I made inside my head to get me by?
We're back with our guest, Jay Richards. Dr. Richards is a senior fellow at the Discovery Institute. He previously worked as a contributing editor to AEI's The American Magazine, visiting fellow at the Heritage Foundation, research fellow with the Acton Institute, and professor at Biola University. His work has appeared in numerous publications, including The New York Times, The Washington Post, and The Wall Street Journal. He's also the author of The New York Times bestsellers Infiltrated and Indivisible, as well as the Templeton Enterprise Award winner Money, Greed, and God. Jay, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Of course. So we were just talking a little bit before. The news today is about Eric Cantor and David Brett, that
right.
whole thing. Nobody had heard anything about that. You
yeah.
said you know.
I do. In fact, a couple of years ago, David Brad is a professor at Randolph-Macon College here in Virginia, and he had me down to speak to students. I think it was actually on my book, Money, Greed, and God. He's a really good guy. He actually has a degree from Princeton Theological Seminary, went on to sort of politics and economics. I was following it because I knew him and, you know, was just sort of checking my email. So I didn't realize how little the race was being covered. But of course, now after the fact, we realized it was quite significant. Significant. So everybody sort of, all the media are saying, okay, what should we have covered?
So did you endorse him or anyway? Is that why he won?
Yeah, it was definitely me. No. I mean, honestly, I think it's just an amazing sort of testimony to the fact that it's still possible to really do a kind of grassroots campaign without a lot of money. He did get endorsed by the popular talk show host Laura Ingraham, which I think did things, but I was following the polls just in the 2 weeks leading up to the primary election. And he essentially cut the lead that Cantor had in half every week until it just continued to surge in the last couple of days, obviously. And I think there's probably an enthusiasm gap, this primary election here. But the voters that were voting really against Cantor and for Dave Brat, they obviously prevailed.
Yeah. Do you think it was more Cantor's fault? You know, people have been saying he ignored his constituents for so long. Do you think that's That's what happened.
I think it was a combination of the fact that Brat honestly ran a sort of enthusiastic campaign, and I think it could have been squelched if Cantor had said, okay, well, this is an actual challenge. I ought to have some town hall meetings. But I think he decided the strategy was just to simply ignore it and hope it would go away. You know, there's going to be a lot of analysis of the election. I suspect that the talk on immigration reform and things like that, which I think probably didn't help Cantor with his constituents. And so, yeah, I think looking back on this, this will be sort of a testimony to incumbent politicians that you can't just assume that a small, not all that well-funded challenger is not going to succeed.
Yeah. I mean, that's the great thing about American politics. You know, the constituents weren't happy, and there you go.
Yeah, absolutely.
Moving on to something a little bit different, you've given a presentation several times called Why Libertarians Need God.
Yeah.
And that's sort of a provocative title. I've heard one of your presentations, and I think that's just a really interesting title and something that we here at Values and Capitalism obviously agree with.
Yeah.
So if you could just, I don't want you to give your whole hour-long lecture, but if you could just give the little gist.
Absolutely.
Of that argument.
Yeah, my basic idea is to say, okay, you know, let's separate the idea of libertarian politics and the Libertarian Party and take what I sort of call in the talk, which is now actually an article with the same name. What are the kind of some of the core libertarian values? So the sort of things that if a person identifies as libertarian, they say they really believe in. So things like what you'll call libertarian freedom, this claim that human individuals have this ability to choose between alternatives, deep commitment to human rights and individual rights, a deep commitment to the capacity of reason, to reason ourselves using arguments and evidence to the conclusion. And then what I call sort of philosophically moral realism, which is just the idea that moral truths are truths. Mm-hmm. They're truths about the nature of reality, that it's wrong for the state to exercise coercive power over people except for certain circumscribed ends. Those are truth claims. And so my question is not, okay, do I agree with them or disagree with them, but rather this, if those are true, or if we're going to take those as true, what account of reality do they best fit in? In other words, if they're real, if moral claims are real and true, if we do have reason, if we do have freedom, are those more likely given a theistic framework, that is, the ultimate reality is a transcendent personal God, or in a materialistic framework in which everything is explained in terms of blind physics and chemistry? My argument is that all of those, quote, libertarian values make a lot more sense in a theistic framework than in a materialistic or atheistic framework. Yeah. And so that's why I say, you want to be a libertarian, you're better served actually being a theist than an atheist.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And one of the things that I thought of when you mentioned that is that there's sort of a movement called secular humanism.
Mm-hmm.
Have you heard of this too?
Yes.
But I kind of think the same thing about that movement, where I saw a video a few months ago that said it's a website called livingwithoutreligion.org, I think. And they're basically advertising their cause, saying, you know, millions of Americans are living happily without religion. And they said, you know, we're living lives of honesty and compassion and justice and all these things.
Mm.
And I said, I kind of thought, what's the, like, what's behind, like, why do you believe in those things? Why are those things important? Is it the same thing for that?
It is. It's a similar thing. And what's funny is that when I was, you know, a kid in high school, I can remember there was a lot of talk about secular humanism.
Mm-hmm.
And in many ways, I think that's been displaced by radical environmentalism and radical sort of animal rights thought, which is in many ways anti-humanist. Because if you're going to say human beings have a sort of special status in the universe, they have a special dignity, you know, this idea of compassion. These are all values. And I think, if you're an atheist, you know just as well as I do that murder is wrong.
Mm-hmm.
The only question is, what does murder mean in your view of reality? I mean, what is the status of moral claims? Moral claims make sense if there's a transcendent and personal God that has always existed. Then, you know, you could think of it as there's a kind of metaphysical context in which those ideas make sense. In a purely materialistic universe with materialistic ideas, I would say, look, the radical animal rights people have just as much claim as the humanists. So, you know, again, I think what these are is they're moral intuitions grounded in the natural law that I say as a Christian, they're part of God's created reality. Atheists have access to those moral truths as well as I do. The only question is, do they make sense in an atheistic framework? And I don't think they do.
How do you... With people who don't believe in God or who aren't theistic, how do you talk about sort of natural law principles? Do you even mention sort of the idea of natural law, or do you just say, you know, at least we agree on these things? You just kind of point out the agreements that you have?
Absolutely. And you know, I debated the late atheist Christopher Hitchens a few years ago at Stanford, and I'd listened to some debates he had with people, and a lot of people that he had debated had argued essentially you can't be good without God, that you wouldn't know what the moral truths are unless you believed in God. Well, I don't think that's true. I mean, I think Christopher Hitchens knew that murder was wrong just as well as I did. And so depending on what you're trying to accomplish, you can just sort of take your moral agreements for granted and then say, okay, let's work from there. Ayn Rand, the well-known atheist, she said, man, every man is an end in himself and not a mere means to the ends of others. I agree. Yeah. The only question is, where does that come from in Rand's worldview? That's sort of a moral principle floating in midair.
All right, so you can be a Christian Randian, but you just have to add, you know, a little bit behind.
I suppose it depends on what you mean by Rand. Yeah, I think if you unpack her, so she had some insights, but I would say that the general Randian perspective is not compatible with Christian theology.
That's fair. That's fair. Moving on to one other thing. So you wrote the conclusion for a book that was produced by the Institute for Faith, Work, and Economics recently. Yes. And the book is called For the Least of These, A Biblical Answer to Poverty. And in this conclusion, you make an analogy about climbing up a mountain. How is poverty connected to climbing up a mountain?
Yeah, like mountain climbing. Well, in the conclusion, I tell the story of Tenzing Norgay and Edmund Hillary, who were the first men, at least on record, to summit Mount Everest, the tallest mountain
way cooler
on the
than
planet.
We will ever
meet. Way cooler, yeah. You can't really, once it's been done, you can't ever do it again. And the reason that's so impressive, the reason Hillary is on the money in New Zealand, which is his home country, is because nobody had done it before. They didn't have a map that gave them a sure way up to the top of the mountain. They didn't have the comfort of previous climbers' footprints. In fact, they didn't even have the comfort of their own footprints on the way down because it had started snowing. We celebrate them because they found the pathway up the mountain. And what I point out in the conclusion is that what happens now, of course, there have been thousands of climbers that have summited Mount Everest. It's still very difficult. It takes years of preparation, hundreds of thousands of dollars, a lot of skill. But most people that really want to summit the mountain, they know the pathway up the mountain. They don't try going up the northern face. They take more or less the same pathway that Hillary and Tenzing Norgay took. And in fact, along the pathway, there are now base camps that weren't there in 1953 when this pair first summited it. Now, what does this have to do with this whole question of poverty? Well, what I say is that in many ways, our knowledge as a highly developed country that enjoys widespread wealth, even in the midst of bad recessions, we're still, historically speaking, have unprecedented wealth, and it's very widely distributed. We have, in many ways, we're like Hillary and Tenzing Norgay. We've summited the mountain. So there's obviously a pathway from poverty to prosperity. How do we get there? I mean, unfortunately, in some ways, we sort of stumbled upon it. We can look back retroactively, and we know that things like property rights, rule of law, a good bit of economic freedom, what I'd say is a kind of a minimally virtuous populace. Everybody doesn't have to be perfectly virtuous, but you need to be minimally virtuous. So most people most of the time aren't stealing from their neighbors, things like this. These kind of cultural preconditions that allow the institutions of wealth creation to take effect and to do what they're supposed to do. And so what I find frustrating is that we actually know the pathway up the mountain. It's arduous, it takes work, but we know the pathway. And yet when we think about poverty in the developing world, we often forget that. We say, well, here's how we became wealthy, but let's try something different. Let's suggest for the developing world that we try government-to-government foreign aid or just try to solve the whole problem with charity or something like that. And to me, that's like telling, inexperienced climbers, oh yeah, why don't you just make up your own route up the mountain and see how it goes? Well, you know how it's going to go. And that's what's frustrating is I say, look, we know the pathway up the mountain. And so what we ought to do if we're concerned about those in the developing world that haven't made the climb is to help them take the climb up the known pathway to prosperity and not try these mostly tried and failed cul-de-sacs, which is what I think we're mostly suggesting for the developing world right now.
So do you think, cultural or societal differences don't make a difference? Do you think, prosperity is one mountain that everyone is climbing and it doesn't make a huge difference whether you're, Muslim or Buddhist or from the Middle East or from America.
Yeah.
Either way, the same system of capitalism or free enterprise is going
to
work.
Well, the way that I define this, I try to define it in the most general way. So yeah. I do think, and in fact, you know, if I were to list the sort of top 10 factors a culture needs, I think cultural beliefs are hugely significant. I mean, if you believe, for instance, that nature is capricious, if you think we're either just subject to fate or you don't know what's going to happen tomorrow, then I suspect that a culture that believes that is not going to do a good job of creating wealth, creating institutions. But in order to have things like science, in order to have things like banking, in order to predict what's going to happen tomorrow, you do, I think, have to have some sense that the world is ordered in a certain way so that it's rational and predictable. And mm-hmm. that's not an exclusively theistic idea, but I think it's not a coincidence that these institutions emerge as they did in a largely Judeo-Christian culture. So I actually do think that these sort of basic Judeo-Christian ideas are very important. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, I wouldn't want to go so far as to say if a culture is not Judeo-Christian, it's incapable of getting these things. And the reason is because I think, you know, Confucianism, for instance, in China, has many of the same sort of cultural consequences that Judaism and Christianity do. So
Coming back to the natural law.
Absolutely. And so on the one hand, these things are very, very important, but I wouldn't want to narrow it so much to imply that a culture that hasn't been exposed to Christianity is just sort of hopelessly lost when it comes to economics. And we know that's not true. We know that places like Singapore and Hong Kong, for instance, which are not majority Christian cultures, nevertheless, they're very prosperous.
Yeah. The other big thing in the news recently has been Piketty and the critique of inequality that has come from capitalism.
Oh, yeah.
So if this is the system that brings people out of poverty into prosperity, why – I mean, do you agree with the kind of argument that he's making that, you know, the system might make people more prosperous, but it also increases inequality?
I mean, it could. You know, I tend to think that especially in high-tech economies, precisely because of the nature of high technology, that some people get fabulously wealthy. I mean, there's an aspect, for instance, to software technology in which it can be replicated, right, sort of without limit. So it's not like a car. Mm-hmm. And so there's a reason that people in the sort of high-tech sectors can get fabulously wealthy. Nevertheless, they get fabulously wealthy by creating things of value that everybody has access to.
Yeah.
And so I really think inequality in itself should not be a moral concern. The question is, what's the source of the inequality? Mm-hmm. You know, the late Steve Jobs, the inequality that exists between him and between me is quite substantial. But of course, his wealth exists because we're enjoying
we're
the benefits
iPhones
of
and,
iPhones.
Yeah, exactly.
And even people that are using Samsungs are benefiting from it by competition. And so I think what you want to sort of look at is good and bad forms of inequality. If there's an inequality in which somebody gets fabulously wealthy by creating value for themselves and others, we shouldn't worry about it. In fact, worrying about it is really probably about envy more than anything else. There is a type of inequality, though, that we might call sort of cronyism, in which people's wealth comes not so much by serving their fellow human beings and creating value, but by their connections to those who hold political power. And that's troubling. Yeah. And I think what happens is that most Americans, we kind of bundle those up together so that we forget that the type of wealth of a person like Steve Jobs is different from the type of wealth by someone like, say, Carlos Slim in Mexico, which is at least in part the result of cozy relationship with those who hold power. And so I just say, don't focus on inequality. Focus on poverty and focus on the good and bad kinds of inequality. And I just think Piketty doesn't, you know, whatever the kind of value of his empirical analysis, doesn't make those basic distinctions.
Kind of related to that, AEI's Mark Perry highlighted a report recently that basically showed that the inequality of incomes of individual Americans has been flat since 1961.
Right.
Yet the inequality of American households and families has increased significantly since 1970. So are there also sort of social, familial aspects of inequality?
Absolutely.
That are,
and you got to disentangle that stuff because, these metrics are going to differ depending on, you know, how frequently people marry, how people frequently they marry before having children, how many children they have, whether the husband and wife both work or one stays home. All those kind of sort of variables have to be teased out. And that's why I tend to think that, whatever the kind of empirical details, what we ought to be concerned with is whether people are capable of emerging from poverty in a culture or they're trapped in it, and whether a culture in general creates value for people, not how much individual net worth individual people have. I just think that's focusing on the wrong problem.
Yeah, agreed. You're releasing a book that is completely different. I actually just noticed this the other day. I hadn't heard of it before. But you're releasing a book with Jonathan Witt from the Acton Institute called The Hobbit Party, The Vision of Freedom That Tolkien Got and the West Forgot.
Yep.
Why are you writing about hobbits?
I mean, honestly, Jonathan Witt and I, he's a PhD in English literature, but we actually grew up together.
No way.
Yeah. And so we were sort of Tolkien geeks in elementary and junior high.
He's
and so,
not.
No. And so in some, yeah, exactly. I don't trust people that weren't Tolkien geeks at one point, but we've kind of wanted to do something like this for a long time. And to be frank, the left has been trying to conscript and co-opt Tolkien for decades, and we think it's really a misuse of his thinking. And because he, of course, wrote all these famous novels and fantasy books that people are familiar with, but also had an extensive personal correspondence in which he expressed his private and personal views, you can actually get a lot of detail about what he thought about economic and political things. And it turns out Tolkien is a very valuable guide, even here in the 21st century. And he, in many ways, we argue in the book, The Hobbit Party, he was able to sort of thread the needle so that, you know, on the one hand, he wasn't a simple kind of mechanistic reductionist that was just sort of endorsing capitalism for the sake of capitalism. But on the other hand, he was actually very discerning about rejecting and resisting the bad economic ideas that were popular in the mid-20th century. And he, in many ways, was able to integrate his economic and political views with a very robust theological understanding of reality. And so our desire is, you know, not to transform Tolkien into Friedrich Hayek, you know, or pretend he was secretly reading Hayek, but to really let him speak for himself. And we think that he's actually a very valuable guide here in 2014 for these things.
Okay. So do you think he made those arguments in the Lord of the Rings books?
Yeah, we think they're embedded in there. And in fact, this isn't just a matter of sort of trying to tease out what's in the narratives. Tolkien very often explained quite explicitly in his personal correspondence what he was about. Now, of course, as he always warned people, the books aren't allegories, but he said it's not allegory, but applicability. But you'd be amazed how much of the stuff actually applies to current day dilemmas that we have with economics, and more actually than Jonathan and I even realized when we started writing the book. So yeah, it'll come out here in the fall.
Okay, so basically Sauron is the state, and it's just, you know, the evil eye looking at...
No, exactly. But even the contrast between Sauron, who is just absolutely evil. I mean, the sort of the metaphor of the ring, it's not just power, it's the power to dominate the wills of others versus Saruman, who we sort of argue is like the realist that was willing to make a deal with the devil, but was ultimately about his own self-interest. Yeah. And so the texture of Tolkien's novels are just infinitely rich. And honestly, I think those conservatives that have found inspiration in Tolkien, we think ultimately have the better of the argument than the progressives who've been trying to use his literature all these years.
Hmm. So as I'm somebody who's trying to write, you know, I blog every once in a while, and I know a lot of our listeners out there are blogging too. And you're somebody who, you know, you have a couple bestsellers. It seems like you just write a book. I mean, you wrote a book about hobbits and sort of thing, just kind of out of nowhere. So how are you so kind of prolific in your writing, and do you just get an idea and kind of go with it, or?
Yeah, a lot of it is getting an idea and being seized with it. I mean, I've had a couple of ideas. I've written proposals that just didn't go anywhere. But most of the time, I mean, honestly, books are in many ways a kind of fruit of an interest. And so it helps to be, it honestly helps to be a little bit obsessive compulsive so that if you get an idea and focus on it, I mean, they say, if you really want to understand a subject, either get a PhD on it, in it, or write a book on it. And so in many ways, books that I write are the things that I'm interested in. Mm. And, you know, in every case, I'm trying to distill the kind of more academic literature into a genre that can be enjoyed by ordinary people that aren't necessarily specialists.
Well, we appreciate that as somebody who fits into that group of people. So kind of related to that, just sort of advice for people. So we just hosted 90 students for our annual summer conference, and we talked a lot about, you know, sort of vocation, calling, you know, what God calls us to do and how we respond to that. Would you give them any advice on that sort of subject about as they're kind of getting out of school and going into the real world? I mean, I'm very much in that same place as well.
Yeah.
So kind of trying to figure out what to do. And yeah, do you have any words
to say? Absolutely. I mean, I'd love to say that there is a known pathway to pursuing your calling, but the reality is that I'm convinced that everyone has a specific and unique calling, that God equips all of us for something that we're supposed to do. Mm-hmm. But he very rarely tells us explicitly, you know, very few people at least have a red phone from heaven in which God says, just do this.
And I thought he said I was supposed to be a basketball player.
No, exactly. But I must have misheard it. I'm sure I was called to Tahiti. I misheard reading this. Yeah, I mean, but the reality is we normally find our calling both from being open and prayerful. Mm-hmm. So you've got to be open or you end up maybe in God's plan B or plan C for your life. But then also look at the doors that open and the doors that close. I know in my own life, openness to the future and it's prayerfulness about what I'm supposed to do when I'm in the process of making decisions. And then pray that the doors that ought to close will close so that you don't waste a lot of time. But the reality is all of your experiences and all the things that you're learning, they are experience. And so if you take them as that, whether it's you're having a great experience or it's serious adversity, see it as an opportunity to learn something and trust that as long as you're open to God's calling, he's going to finally show you what that is and you'll see how these other things work into your personal narrative. But you almost always see that only in retrospect and never ahead of the time. So, I mean, honestly, the best piece of advice I could give to sort of young folks in their early 20s is to work hard and to stay open and to stay prayerful.
Okay, that's a good word. Well, it's also a good place to end on. Thanks again for joining us, Jay. We really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Have a great day. All right, we'll be back next time.